The state cost per student in Iowa's K-12 public schools is more than $6,000 a year, increasing steadily over the past couple decades. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. I'll talk with Iowa City's school superintendent to find out how they estimate their budget for the coming year, and with lawmakers who disagree over how much growth should be allowed for the education budget. In the second half of the show, we'll learn about the governor's plan to attract veterans to the state through tax-exempt pension legislation and increased education opportunities for service members recently home from deployment. Join our conversation after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Democrats who hold the majority in the Iowa Senate want to boost state education funding for the 2015-16 school year. But the Republican governor and Republicans controlling the state House have shown little interest in considering the proposal this year. Legislation to increase state funding for the school year that starts in the fall of 2015 was approved by the Senate. And that's an early hurdle now as we move forward. Under state law, the General Assembly is supposed to establish funding levels for kindergarten through 12th grade education more than a year in advance. Lawmakers have not always followed that law. Governor Terry Branstad has called the law outmoded. He also said the state could not afford the 6% budget increase that Democrats are seeking. We're going to talk with an Iowa school superintendent and Senator Herman Kornbach, an Ames Democrat who chairs the Senate Education Committee, in just a moment. But first, Republican Representative Ron Jorgensen of Sioux City is the chair of the House Education Committee. He had a conflict today and couldn't join us here in the Iowa Capitol Law Library. I interviewed him by phone. I started our conversation by asking whether or not he agreed with the governor in that the state cannot afford the 6% budget increase Democrats are calling for.
I would agree with that. The whole issue is the governor has a two-year budget that we've agreed to, and that is done in every odd year that we're in Des Moines. So it was set for fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15. And setting a budget in fiscal year 16 is really making a major future financial commitment without even knowing what the revenue projections are or what the other needs are. And when you relate the 6%, if the legislature would have approved a 6% increase in supplemental aid that the Democrats are pushing, fiscal year 16, the revenue growth would need to be about 3.43%. But if you add that fiscal year 16 funding for the education reform package, the revenue growth would need to be 4.29%. And when you look at over the last 20 years, revenue growth has averaged about 3.27%. So if we're going to be, if it's growing at 4.29% as the projections are, and the revenue only grows at the average at 3.227, we have a budget problem, which means roughly $222 million would need to be cut to balance the spending with ongoing revenues. And we just feel that's just not a prudent way of doing your budget.
And quickly, there seems to be a disagreement over terminology of what we're even calling this funding. Democrats call it allowable growth. You just referred to it as supplemental aid. Why is there this difference in terminology?
Well, in the reform package we passed last year, we changed the name. It's no longer called allowable growth. It's called state supplemental aid. So we're referring to the correct terminology through House File 215 that changed that name.
And House File 215 was the major education reform that happened last session, correct?
Yes, exactly.
So how can you rely to implement a program like that without really knowing how funding levels will work into the near future?
Well, I think that's why we have to be very prudent in our budgeting, and we need to stop promising everything to everyone and then not delivering. And so that's why I think it's very crucial that when we're making future commitments and as big as the state supplemental aid number, We need to do it within the budget process that we've set up, the two-year budget process, where you have revenue projections, knowing what the other needs of the state are, and then matching what our ongoing revenues and ongoing expenses are to make sure that we could honor those commitments. The current system we have has been a failure. Because of overpromising and not delivering, you can go back to fiscal year 02, where we had to have across-the-board cuts. Fiscal year 03, the school aid appropriation was underfunded by the state. Fiscal year 04, we had across-the-board cuts. Fiscal year 09, across-the-board cuts, and the school aid appropriation was underfunded by the state. And then in fiscal year 10, again, we had the 10% across-the-board cuts, and the school aid appropriation was once again underfunded by the state. In fact, in that year, when we talk about following the law, the Democrats over in the Senate unanimously approved a bill that says we're not going to set, at the time, allowable growth within the first 30 days. So they themselves, through maybe a very good reason, decided that they were going to skirt the law themselves also.
So with the cost for funding the state's education going up every year, wouldn't it make sense to have a conversation about how to plan for those 2 years out, if not 6% at a lower percent? I think I heard you mention 4.2%. What if, I mean, is that the conversation that should be taking place in your eyes instead of whether or not we even talk about funding for 2 years down the road?
Well, I think it makes sense to follow. If we have a two-year budget, let's plan for 2 years, and we could set state supplemental aid for those 2 years. I have just recently filed a bill that essentially does that, and what it does is it says that not the school districts know this year what they're working with. They know that for fiscal year 15, it's 4% state supplemental aid, so they could certify their budgets this year. They could do their labor contracts this year, but for fiscal year 16, the next year, my proposed bill says within 30 days of the governor submitting his budget, we have to set state supplemental aid for fiscal year 16. So again, school districts have the ability to certify their budgets and do labor negotiation for fiscal year 16. And then we have to set state supplemental aid before we adjourn the session next year for fiscal year 17. So every odd year that we're in the legislature, we set the two-year number that school districts can use for planning. And it's in sync with the budget, with revenue forecasts that we have, and with knowing what the other needs to make sure that we're going to be able to honor these commitments. And we don't get into the almost annual situation of having across-the-board cuts and underfunding education. You know, by doing it the way we're doing it right now, we're not doing school districts justice. We're not showing a commitment to school districts because we're over-promising things. This gives us a much better chance of honoring our commitments and properly funding education.
I also read in a recent memo from House Republicans a comment about education funding that said it was at its highest level in the last 30 years. Why is that?
Well, I think with the education reform package that we passed last year, that was a huge investment in education. And I saw a recent, we're committed to education. It needs to be targeted investment, and that's what we did last year in the reform bill. But it also has to be strategic to make sure that what we're investing in is actually working and improving instruction and improving outcomes for kids. Since I saw a report since 2008 during the recession years, from 2008 to current, the percentage increase in funding to education in Iowa was the second largest in the whole country. So, you know, for some to say we don't have a commitment to education, I think is false. We do have a commitment to education, but it needs to be a targeted commitment. And just to quote the per pupil spending in the state compared to the rest of the country, is not totally accurate because I'm hearing statistics that we're 37th in the country. Well, I could show another report that we're 28th. And regardless of that, in my mind, just because you have a higher per pupil spending doesn't necessarily equate to quality and performance. You know, we have states across the country that spend less per pupil than we do that have better results on test scores. Colorado, Idaho, North Dakota are all spending less than we do but have better results. And we have districts that spend quite a bit more per pupil than we do that are a lot worse than we are. So, you know, it all relates to how you use the dollars.
So how much is it costing the state right now? Millions of dollars?
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at the total standings bill, I think the total aid right now, state budget, is approaching, if I remember right, around $2.9
billion. And
so it's a little over, I think the last statistics I showed was 43% of the whole state's budget. And that's where I'm saying it does not make sense from a prudent budgeting practice to budget 43% of your total state's budget outside of the budget process without any revenue projections or knowing what your other needs are. That's a formula that's going to relate to underfunding commitments like we have been doing.
And the 6% increase that the Democrats have talked about, would you see that if it was, for some reason, did get through and there was a 6% increase, is that something you think would have to be paid for by the surplus? Would it be unavoidable that you'd have to dip into surplus funds for that?
Well, you know, our budgeting philosophy is always we are not going to approve a budget that funds ongoing expenses with one-time revenues. And that has been the problem we've had in the past in the state, and that's why almost regularly in the past we've had to have across-the-board cuts to balance the budget. You know, we changed the – Republicans outlined a whole new budgeting process with new budgeting principles that I just mentioned over the last 3 years. And I just recently saw a report, a national publication, that listed Iowa as one of the best-run states in the country. I think we were number three. So, you know, we don't want to go back to a situation where we're having to make across-the-board cuts. Let's prudently budget, prudently manage, so that issue doesn't come up.
All right. Representative Ron Jorgensen, he's the chair of the House Committee on Education, a Republican from Sioux City. Thanks, Representative.
Very good. Good to be with you.
What are your thoughts? Are you a parent, a teacher, listening during your lunch break? Do you think the state should follow the law and set the state aid? Or should lawmakers do as the governor suggests and change the law? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. With me in our Iowa City studio is the superintendent of the Iowa City School District, Stephen Murley. Stephen, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And sitting with me here in the Iowa Capitol Law Library is Senator Herman Kornbach, an Ames Democrat and chair of the Senate Education Committee. Senator, thanks for being back on River to River.
My pleasure.
So, Superintendent Murley, you heard a lot of what Representative Jorgensen laid out. How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I fully understand the idea that you want to be conservative with your budgeting and you want to make sure that your revenues and your expenditures are in line with each other from a long-term sustainability process. Yeah, that's a huge challenge for us as a school district because repeatedly over the last few years, the legislature has failed to set the budget in a timely manner, and we've been forced to move forward and establish our budgets by our state statutory regulations and have done so without full knowledge of what our budget would be. And that's been detrimental to us as we look at sustainability of staffing and programs without a guarantee for what our income will be.
So how does that impact the students? How does it impact the teachers, the people that you work with on a daily basis?
Not knowing what your income is and recognizing that in most districts 80% or more of your budget is allocated to staff in the classrooms, you're very conservative as you set your staffing ratios and as you go about doing new hires, and that often leads to increases in class size.
And Senator Kornbach, there seems to even be a disagreement on what to even call this funding more than a year out. You heard Representative Jorgensen calling it supplemental aid. We hear allowable growth. What's going on here?
Well, everybody knows it is allowable growth. I think the school personnel throughout the state understand that term and have worked with it for many years. The Republicans seem to think that they can avoid the problem by changing the name. I don't think that's going to wash.
Because supplemental makes you think, oh, it's extra costs.
No, this is the foundational formula. This is the core of a funding of what our school districts depend on. Part of it is local property tax. Part of it is state aid. And that's the number that they have to work with to do the basic things like pay teachers and order textbooks and so forth.
Superintendent Murley, you had a chance to talk with Governor Terry Branstad about the aid for 15-16. How'd that conversation go?
He was very adamant. First of all, make sure you do call it supplemental state aid. He was very adamant that he did not wish to see that set this year. One of the things that forces school districts to do is have a very, very small window to get their budget planning done. And that's if the legislators actually do follow through and get the authorization passed in a timely manner within that 30-day window starting next year.
So, Senator Kornbach, a lot of these shows last year, we were talking about the education reform package that was passed.
Mm-hmm.
How can you pass large bipartisan legislation about education reform when you're not setting what kind of challenges does that face? Do superintendents like Superintendent Murley face?
Well, sure. We're challenging our local school districts to be innovative, to develop the teacher leadership compensation models. They've supposed to have submitted their proposals to the state by last week's deadline. We're going to be looking at those. And we have promoted in a number of ways innovative approaches in the education reform bill in 2012. The main emphasis there was on early grade reading. But, you know, it's nice to do new things and use modern approaches, but you have to keep the lights on. You have to pay your staff. You have to do the basics. And that's what allowable growth is all about.
And help us understand here, when, you know, the cost of education continues to go up and we talk about these new reforms that are happening, what does that allow besides just, you know, planning for salaries for teachers? Put into perspective the scope of funding for that out in advance.
Here's the central fact. Our financial support for Iowa kids in Iowa schools is $1,500 per student per year below the national average. $1,500 per student per year. We don't have to be number one in the country. I mean, our cost of living isn't number one in the country. But to be $1,500 below average, we slipped from 31st place to 37th place in just 1 year last year. And Representative Jorgensen says he has other surveys that said, well, we're only 28th. I'm sorry, being below average is not what Iowa is all about. We expect our schools to perform and to educate our students, you know, at the very top tier. But at some point, you can't produce top results with below average funding. We need the 1500. We need to begin to close that gap. Now, the 6% that we are proposing in the Senate this year, it translates to only $382 per student. So we're only proposing to close about one quarter of the gap. We have a lot more ways to go before we even get up to the national average. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this is a matter of priorities. You know, a wise man once said, don't tell me your priorities. Show me your budget, and I'll tell you your priorities. Well, as long as I've lived in Iowa, priority one has been our kids. It doesn't seem to be that with the Republicans anymore.
You heard Representative Jorgensen talk about 2002 and 2003. There's a lot of references back to when Governor Culver, that there were cuts 10% across the board.
Well, what he didn't tell you was that in fiscal 02 and 03 and 04, the Republicans held a majority in the legislature. So he's criticizing his own party for failing to keep their promises. We will keep ours.
So how do you move forward with this when you have the governor and House Republicans? How do you reach some kind of a compromise, or do you compromise on this? Or if you don't compromise, what's the impact for somebody like Superintendent Murley?
Well, I think that the other side has to be willing to come to the table. If they don't like 6%, tell us what their number is. All right. But we have to obey the law. I mean, this is what it comes down to at the most basic level. We have a law, which, by the way, Governor Branstad signed into law back in, I think it was 1995, that says that we have to set the allowable growth number within the first 30 days. The Senate will do that. We will be passing our allowable growth bill this week. But so far, I have seen no action from the House. The governor ignored the subject in his condition of the state address. If they don't like 6%, tell us what their number is, okay? But let's agree on the most basic thing. We have to obey the law.
So, Superintendent Murley, at what point do you start getting the pink slips ready?
Well, and let me back up for just a minute and echo something that Senator Kornbach said. If you look back to 2001, too, you see that the gap between what we were spending here in Iowa on a per-pupil basis and what was being spent at the national level was about $400. And since that time, in the last decade, we've slipped to a $1,500 gap that he pointed out. And Senator Jorgensen is right. We were 28. That was back in 2009-10. So we continue to slide against the national average. And what that means is our costs continue to go up every year. If you look across our entire budget and aggregate it on an annual basis, our budget goes up by about 4% in terms of expenses. And as that gap continues to deepen, it begins to erode our ability to do things that are new and innovative. It makes it difficult for us to develop new programs as we try to sustain those programs that our constituents expect to be in place. From a budgeting standpoint, we wind up being very, very conservative, both in staffing and in terms of developing new programming, because that lack of certainty in funding makes it hard for us to look over the horizon and really plan effectively for the future.
And how has the new education reform from last session, have you been able to crack this thing open and implement any of it in the Iowa City schools?
Yes, we're seeing pieces of that come into play. We talk about the implementation of the Iowa Core and the Common Core State Standards, looking forward to the assessment pieces that go along with that. I think it's important to recognize, though, that none of that comes without a cost. Obviously, there's professional development for our staff. We've got new assessment programs that must be implemented in order to comply with that. And absent new money for that, those dollars have to come from somewhere else inside our budget.
And there were some education advocacy groups that were saying that not enough was done in last year's package to help students, that it was more teacher-focused. Is that your viewpoint?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to recognize is that the most important influence on a student's life is the teacher in the classroom. They have the greatest level of impact, and so we want to make sure that our teachers are effective in the classroom and as effective as possible. And so much of the work that was done in the reform package is designed to increase the efficacy of the work that's done by our teachers. And so I think that does directly benefit our students. So I don't think we can downplay that. I think we need to recognize the importance of investing in our staff. That investment pays off over time as their success in the classroom increases, and we see that in higher levels of student achievement. And I think you can see that across the state as you look at achievement scores. Certainly within our district, you see that on an annual basis, whether we look at growth with our intact cohorts, the students that have been with us, our students overall. You're seeing a high level of success. And the more that the core is implemented in the classroom, the more effective we're seeing our teachers deliver instruction and our students produce in terms of those assessment scores.
Okay, Superintendent Stephen Murley, this is where we're going to have to wrap up for this first half of the show. Thanks for being with us today on River to River.
Thank you for having me.
And Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from the Senate Education Committee, he's not going anywhere. He's staying for the second half, where we'll discuss a bill that aims to keep and recruit Iowa veterans here in the state. That's coming up in the second half of our hour. It's River to River. We're live from the State Capitol Law Library on Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. The Iowa Senate recently voted to exempt military retirement pay from state income taxes. Its intentions are to encourage more veterans to stay, come back, or move to Iowa. The bill is also, or a bill similar, is expected to pass in the House. Here with us to talk about the bill is Senator Herman Kornbach, who was with us for the first half. Welcome back to the second half. And Representative Matt Winschittle, a Republican from Missouri Valley. Thanks for being on River to River.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Senator Kornbach, tell us about what recently passed in the Senate.
Well, I floor managed the bill. It was Senate File 303. And basically, it's quite simple. It exempted military retirement pay from state income taxation. Now, military retirement pay, we're talking about the retirement pay that people get after 20 or more years of service in the U.S. Armed Forces. I believe the National Guard was also included in there. A recognition of people having given at least half of their career or more to service to the country. It seemed like an appropriate thing to do. The governor has proposed doing that as part of his home base Iowa program, and that is one piece that we have already agreed to in the Senate.
So younger veterans that have served in Afghanistan or Iraq, they wouldn't see any immediate benefit from this. It would be other elements that are in the governor's plan?
Well, we have done quite a number of things over the years to help out service members and their families. A few years back, the Department of Defense promulgated a list of 10 things that they, policies that they were encouraging states to adopt. And we were the first state in the country to do all 10. So we have a long and strong record of supporting service members and their families and veterans.
Representative Winschittle, how is this taking shape in the House?
Well, this is very similar to a proposal we passed out of the House Veterans Affairs Committee last year. And because it is a tax policy, it did go to the House Ways and Means Committee. And where we have it now, I'm the chair of the subcommittee over there. We're working it through the process. We're looking at the fiscal impact and the current estimates we have right now. If we were to implement this exactly as the Senate passed it, it would be roughly an $8 to $10 million hit annually on the state general fund budget. I think that is something that is very manageable, and I think the benefit of it, recruiting these veterans that are retired from the military but still have a lot of work and a lot of life left in them, I think the benefit of getting those folks here into Iowa and staying in Iowa is something that we definitely need to be looking at and recognizing.
And that $8 to $10 million figure, is that something that Democrats in the Senate are comfortable with as well?
The estimate, I believe, for FY14 was $8.6 million, rising to $10 million in FY18. Yes.
Okay. We want to bring another voice into the conversation, Iowa State economist Dave Swenson. Dave joins us in our Ames office, our Ames studio, rather. Professor Swenson, welcome to River to River.
Hi.
So how do you see this impacting the state's workforce? You've spent a lot of time looking at job numbers and research in job creation. How would it impact Iowa?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that this is a policy that has a lot of affection, and by both, you know, bipartisan affection. We all want to acknowledge the veteran services, and this is one thing. Now, moving over, though, to saying that this is an effective way to develop the state's economy, well, that's one of those things you can research and try to take a good look at. First of all, the $8 to $10 million that they're spending on this isn't going to really do anything for the economy initially because those folks are already here. So what you're looking at is, will this policy push towards attracting the kind of workers that the state of Iowa needs to help match up with what are some anticipated shortfalls in the state's economy? And that's the great big question. And I really haven't seen any research that answers that question. This feels more like catch-as-catch-can. And I would like to see an evaluation of what are we trying to recruit? What can we do for the state's economy, but more to the point, what can we do for veterans who are needing work?
And you yourself, you're a veteran too, right?
That's correct. That's correct. But so, I had the good sense to retire after 3 years, not 20 years.
Okay, got it. So what kind of workers does Iowa need? You brought that up.
Well, we do. We need a wide range of workers. We need workers who are able to acquire a wide set of technical skills, our manufacturing, for example, machinery, welding. We need a wide range of technical skills in our healthcare, in our information services sectors. And in general, and the research that I've done looks at the state of Iowa actually struggling to maintain its core workforce simply because we've got some bad demographics at work. We have way more people retiring than we have people coming into the workforce. So on the face of it, this looks good. But the effectiveness of this is something that I wish, as an evaluator, I wish it would be spelled out more. Exactly what kind of skills are we looking for? Which members of the service are we trying to attract? And what can we as Iowa offer these service menus beyond just what Senator Kornbach said? Well, we've got education benefits and housing benefits and a range of other things. What else are we offering these folks?
Representative Winchittle.
And I appreciate what you're saying, but keep in mind, as part of the Governor's Home Base Iowa initiative, it is much broader than just this income tax exemption for retired military. What you've pointed out is the type of workers that we need, the jobs that are out there, and how do we get people qualified for those jobs. That's exactly what the Governor's proposing in the Home Base Iowa initiative. That's part of the education package, is finding those highly qualified workers that have been trained by our military and maybe don't have all of the technical information they need or the technical training, being able to take those people that are retiring and or coming off or out of the military and get them the additional training they may need on an expedited fashion or in an expedited fashion so that we can turn them right back around, help them to become even more productive in the workforce out there, and put them right back into helping grow Iowa's economy and attract even more people into our state.
Well, I would offer this back. First of all, Iowa is at a competitive disadvantage for attracting veterans. And if I look at the number of retirees under age 65, Iowa ranks about 40th. And in most things, we rank in around 30. But with regard to retirees under 40, under 65, we rank about 40th. Well, we have a competitive disadvantage. Why is that? Well, one of the reasons is we don't have military bases in Iowa, and many retirees, if not most retirees, really do like to retire near military bases because there are other benefits associated with being close to those benefits. You have health care privileges. You have commissary privileges. Also, that tends to be where you may have bought a house towards the end of your term. So getting people into Iowa, obviously it would be good to get more veterans into the state of Iowa, more retirees, especially the young retirees, not the older retirees. There's nothing wrong with them. But the point is you're really trying to attract a set of workers that we think are in their core earning, their peak earning potential and their peak service providing potential. And that seems to suggest that we need some strategies for that besides just offering a tax credit. So I'm interested in seeing how this plays out over time.
I'd like to bring in another perspective here. Colonel Robert King, the Executive Director of the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs. Colonel King, how do you see this impacting the servicemen and women? Are you hearing what you're hearing from Professor Swenson and thinking about how that might impact your service members?
Well, I think it'll have a very positive effect down the road, and I applaud the governor for putting in the Home Base Iowa Initiative package. You know, one of the things that hasn't been mentioned yet is the non-tangibles that the veterans who come off of active duty bring with them. I mean, leadership skills abound, and you know, I've talked to employers that say, you know, the leadership skills that my veterans, my members of the Guard, the Reserve, people I've hired off of active duty, you know, I can't pay for that. So that's a huge commodity, and I think that makes them right up front employable. They bring skills that are easily transferable. You know, they're the kind of people that become very active in the community. A lot of them are married. They have kids that are going to assimilate into the local communities. They've got wives that may or may not have worked when they were on active duty, but those are the same wives that will become involved in the community. So I think we're getting a good pick for the investment. And, you know, another thing that I would go on to say, I've sat in several meetings that had to do with some off-reaches of what we're talking about. But I listened to two people very specifically tell me that they came off of active duty in the past several years, and in both cases, at the active duty post, Iowa was on a list of five states don't go to because there are no benefits for them. And for a number of years, Iowa has been, you know, way at the bottom of the list of the types of benefits that were available to veterans in the state. And I just think that that we're making a good move to make the investment in an attempt to get people here. And I think that, will we see an immediate impact? I don't know. I think we will. I think we'll see people who will start showing up at our door and saying, I came here because Iowa finally has some benefits. But I also think that in the long term, it'll be worth the effort that the state's invested into it to get the right kind of people here off of active duty and those that are leaving the military and get them to come to Iowa and stay in Iowa to live, to work, and to raise their families.
Dave Swenson, do you see leadership skills, as the colonel talks about, that are going to benefit the private sector?
Well, I do believe that leadership skills are important. I do believe that the ability to get tasks done are important. The state of Iowa, though, hasn't been advertising a shortage of leadership skills. It's been advertising a shortage of a set of very, very tangible skills, most of them having to do with our core industries. Again, it has something to do with the ability to assimilate into and be productive in manufacturing or in finance and banking and insurance and in biotech and emerging Iowa technology industries. We need a wide range of workers, and we do need leaders. Iowa is looking, though, at its and really struggling with being able to retain its younger workers. That's the big issue that we're wrestling with in Iowa. And the other part of the governor's initiative may help in that area much more than this one. I'm still having trouble figuring out where this one's going to make a big difference in our overall labor force needs. I don't see it as a detriment. I'm just saying I don't believe it's going to have that big of an impact. It's the long-term ability to retain and attract young workers that's going to be key to the state's economy growing over the next decade.
So, Senator Kornbach, do you see this making a big difference, this piece of the puzzle?
Well, let me say first, as I think some of you know, in my other life, I'm also an economics professor at Iowa State, and Dave Swenson has been a friend and colleague of mine for many mm-hmm. years. He does fabulous research on a wide variety of topics, and it's always interesting to listen to his point of view. Let me build on one point that he mentioned back a bit. We don't have any military bases here in Iowa. But historically, we've always had a very large number of volunteers. I mean, going all the way back to the Civil War, Iowa lost more fatalities in the Civil War per capita than any other state in the Union. And that tradition, the tradition of volunteering and tradition of service have continued. So you have a lot of people who grew up here in Iowa. They volunteer, they sign up, they enlist, and then they go off someplace else because we, in fact, don't have any military bases here. So I'm thinking that with a little bit of a tax break on their retirement pay, and remember, these people are coming here in their 40s or early 50s. They're going to be working someplace else, and they're going to be paying taxes on the civilian income that they have here. Giving them a little bit of tax break on their military pay, I think, may in fact have some leverage. I'd point out one other thing. You know, retirement is a very complex decision. It involves economic and non-economic factors. I mean, where's your family? What about the climate? What about your finances? People who have put their career into the military have often moved around quite a lot and have not developed a close attachment to any one state. So I think that the financial factors may, in fact, be a little bit more salient here. Do I have an academic study to prove that? No. Dave, if you're up for working together, I'd be happy to work together with you on that project. But right now, I've heard from a lot of veterans the same kind of testimony that others have offered. Anecdotally, a lot of people have told me, including just last Saturday, I was talking with a friend of mine. A lot of people in the military do look at that, is what we're told.
On the line right now, we have Lynn Ford, a Marine Corps veteran of Vietnam. Lynn, you have no problem with the tax exemptions, but you're a little disappointed. Why is that?
Well, I think I'm a little disappointed in that many vets, while supporting the tax break, really look at this thing as really inconsequential. Those of us in business, we take a look at the $8 to $10 million and say, really, what is our return on investment going to be? We then look at some of the other things that have gone on. Aside from what you have talked about, developing jobs and so on, which are all noble. But folks, as Representative Windschittle probably knows as much as anybody, we have a tsunami of mental health problems headed our way from the Middle Eastern wars. PTSD, early onset dementia are just two as an example. There are those of us that feel maybe this $8 to $10 million would be better spent in developing mental health facilities to assist. Now, certainly the federal government and the VA is doing a much better job in taking care of our veterans as it applies to mental health. But mental health also affects families and the community. And there isn't any assistance from the federal government in that regard. So we're skeptical, I think many of us, of what this will do. We kind of look at this, I mean, let's face it, guys, it's an election year. It's an easy thing to support and say we're all for this, but the overused phrase from Vietnam, talking the talk but not walking the walk, in many of our views here.
Okay, thanks, Lynn, for that perspective. I want to go to Representative Winschittle. He mentioned you. You were with the Marine Corps for 8 years and had a tour in Iraq in 2005 as well. How do you respond to Lynn?
Well, Lynn, first and foremost, Semper Fi, thank you for your service and your time. It gave me the opportunity to serve in mine. I couldn't agree with you more that there are a lot of people that are going to be coming back from the Middle East that are going to be having problems. I mean, we've already seen a lot of those veterans that have needed help. And you're correct. The federal government has done a better job than what they've done in the past of trying to not only recognize those, diagnose those issues, but also provide service for them. Here on a state level, we're doing, in my opinion, everything we can to try and identify where there might be gaps in the system, where there might be shortfalls, where we can provide more benefit, more information, and more services to those veterans that need help. We've got county veteran service affairs officers in all 99 counties that are trying to do outreach to veterans, that not just veterans from your era, but also veterans from the current wars that we've been in, to try and reach out to them and make sure that we're providing everything we can to those people that have fought for our freedoms and liberties. So if there's areas where we need to make more investment, that you see that maybe this $8 to $10 million might be better suited going, we're more than willing to open up those doors and look at those things. But at the same time, this is part of an overall package to try and bring as many qualified veterans into the state as possible. And if there's services that need to go along with that, we'll absolutely be willing to look at those areas.
Senator Kornbach?
Well, I agree with the caller. He's pointed to an extremely important problem, PTSD and related mental health issues. We need to address those. They're very serious. I think that the VA is now doing a better job with that than they were previously. But our record on this is not a very good one historically. The neglect, let's call it what it was, the neglect that our Vietnam veterans got when they returned and suffered from many of the same problems. We need to do better by the current generation of veterans. And I think there's still Vietnam veterans who could still use our assistance. In terms of the price tag, though, I think it's a much bigger problem than just $8 or $10 million. I think it's many times that. The state needs to address it. The federal government needs to address that. The costs of war don't end when the conflict ends. We brought our troops home from Iraq. We're bringing the troops home from Afghanistan. But for a lot of them, the war will go on for many years.
So will these other parts of home-base Iowa start cropping up then as other issues to take up in the Senate and the House? How will we see this legislation continue to flesh itself out?
Well, I think we have a committee process. The different elements here, I'm guessing, will be assigned to the respective relevant committees, and they will proceed forward with them.
We've already taken steps in the House Veterans Affairs Committee to look at the broader package, and we'll begin the process of paring that down, sending it to the appropriate subcommittees so that we can make sure that we get all the information we need on these, adjust them as necessary to provide the benefit of what we're looking at doing for veterans and making sure that it's crafted appropriately, and working in conjunction with the Senate as best we can in a bipartisan fashion to move this initiative forward and see where we can get.
And Dave Swenson, associate scientist at ISU, so are you going to start a study now?
Well, we are doing a study, but it's important to know this. Iowa's veterans, the ones we have, are well assimilated into the economy. They're part of the economy. They're important to the economy. They do not distinguish themselves in terms of earnings or education level. They're very, very similar to the rest of Iowa. So attracting veterans is probably fine in terms of the long, long-term goals. But for the short term, the state of Iowa's big issue is just people.
Okay. Thanks so much to Dave Swenson, Associate Scientist at ISU. Thanks for being on the show today, as well to my other guests, Missouri Valley Republican Representative Matt Winschittle and Ames Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach. Thanks, guys, for joining me, as well as Executive Director of the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs, Colonel Robert King. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble, Jason Burns, and Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us at any time, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you.